You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Let's talk.
Giles Brown.
You're listening to Giles Brown on Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Bear witness the pursuit of justice in a violent land. The vast majority of Hondurans would never dare to set foot in Nueva Suyupa, a mountain Siberia that was under the thumb of a gang whose bravado and cruelty were the stuff of legend. What happened next is the subject of a fascinating, inspiring and also worrying book. It is a book by Ross Halperin. Delighted to say that Ross joins me live on the line from the west coast of the States this morning. Ross, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
How you doing? Great to be here.
Pleasure is indeed all mine. What's your background, Ross, by the way? Why are you uniquely qualified to write Bear Witness?
Well, I grew up in suburban New York, went to Harvard and got a statistics degree, and then did finance for a while, and was an investor at a big bank in New York. And then I got interested in criminology back in like 2014, 2015, and started studying the issues of policing and crime and impunity, and got hooked up with this amazing criminologist named Mark Kleiman. And, you know, we were back in 2017 looking at this problem of impunity. I was actually working with a friend of his, another criminologist by the name of David Kennedy, who's based at John Jay. And he's this really interesting guy. You know, he's not just an academic. He's really someone who knows how to go into some of the most dangerous neighborhoods in the United States and work with police and prosecutors and the community to drastically reduce gun violence. And back in the summer of 2017, he and I, by extension, got really interested in this problem of impunity. So this might surprise some of your listeners who are probably primarily European, or maybe it won't. But, you know, whereas in wealthy democracies in Europe and Asia, upwards of 90% of homicides tend to be solved. In the United States, the solve rate is much lower. So maybe it's 60% nationally. And in certain places like Chicago, it's way lower than that. And the solve rate for non-fatal shootings is even more disturbingly low. So we studied that problem closely and started thinking about potential solutions for it. And it was through that work that I met Kurt Verbeek, who ended up being the subject of my book. And, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this in a moment, but he and his partner, Carlos, had developed a solution to impunity and gang violence in a place that was way more dangerous than even the worst neighborhoods of Chicago. So I was fascinated in the program that they had developed, and I was just fascinated in them as people as well.
Because the background is, well, Carlos Hernandez is a school teacher. We're talking about Honduras. Now, for somebody of my generation, you know, born in the 60s, Honduras is, you know, Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, this is Central America, this is death squads, this is disappearances, this is the breakdown, you know, this is people getting the knock on the door in the middle of the night and never seen again. And obviously places like El Salvador and now have sort of high profile ways of dealing with criminality. But what is Carlos's sort of starting point, his chispa, if you like, and how does Kurt get involved with this?
Yeah, so Carlos grew up in rural Honduras, sort of near the Caribbean coastline. And, you know, he's this young man who, from a young age, is very devoted to helping others and is sort of in rebellion against the evangelical church. I mean, he's a very Christian religious person, and he's a member of the evangelical church. But he doesn't like how head in the clouds his congregation is and how focused everyone is on the afterlife and converting people and praying. And he believes in all that stuff, but he says, we as Christians also have to do something about the here and now, about this country that is so poor and corrupt and violent. And, you know, the first really radical thing that he does is move to Nueva Suyapa, which is one of the poorest and most dangerous barrios in all of Honduras. And pretty soon thereafter, a gringo who also happened to be down there as well and had a similar humanitarian mission, Kurt's from suburban Chicago, but moved to Honduras with his wife right after college. He moves to Nueva Suyapa too. And, you know, for a gringo, that's even a wilder thing to do, especially since at the time Kurt was married and he had two children. But same idea as Carlos. It's like, if we're going to help the poor, we should live like them too. And, you know, they spend the first 5 or 10 years that they're there doing all the normal things that people do to help the poor. So build a school, microlending, health clinic, land titling, and they do it to a really impressive and successful degree. But there comes a point where they look around and they say, look, if there's a gang here that is killing people, hurting people, extorting people, scaring people every which way, then all that stuff isn't going to make that much of an impact. So we are going to change direction. We are going to do something that missionaries and humanitarians rarely do, and that is we are going to take on crime directly. We are going to take on this gang.
Just so a couple of things here, Ross. What time period are you talking about here? Because, I mean, I will always automatically go back to 80s / 90s, but this is a more recent event?
This is more recent, yes. Yeah. So, I mean, Carlos moved to Nueva Suyapa, this neighborhood, in like the mid-90s, and Kurt and his wife Joanne moved there in the late 90s. And then this realization that they have, and this is really where the book starts, is in 2005.
And the other thing is, because again, I don't want to go to stereotypes or caricatures, because it's very easy to think, okay, well, it's Central America, it's all guys with big mustaches and aviator shades, and you've got, you know, cartels on one side doing drugs, and then you've got sort of paramilitaries on the other side. I mean, what's the political situation there? What's the society like? And what are the main, because, you know, you don't want to go down that sort of, narcos is kind of, and I know that South America, it's different, but it's kind of glamorized or allow people to put these nationalities, these groups, into neat little boxes, and life's not like that.
Yeah, no, of course not. I mean, there's a lot of different things going on in the country, but I mean, you talk about narco trafficking. It's true that cocaine is manufactured in Colombia and Venezuela and Bolivia typically. But it has a huge impact on Honduras, a hugely negative impact, because back in the 80s, the U.S. walled off the traditional route for cocaine, which was up through the Caribbean Sea on boats and planes. And what happened over the ensuing decades is the route slowly shifted westward. So the Andean cartels would get it to Honduras, and then the Honduran narcos would be these middlemen who would get it to the Mexican cartels, which would bring it overland through the United States. So just imagine, I mean, how much money that is, how much crime that is, how much big time, you know, bad guys that is, and passing through this small, poor country with very weak institutions. So that's been a terribly corrupting influence. And then, you know, I mean, just to talk a little bit about another factor, which is really relevant, it's, you know, the weakness of policing in Nueva Suyapa. I mean, this is a police force that is, first of all, extremely poor. So, you know, there might be 20 detectives in a city of 1 million people where it's one of the most violent cities in the world. And they may have access to 3 vehicles and they might not have gas money. So it's very hard for them to do their job. They're often scared to go into neighborhoods like Nueva Suyapa. And then there's corruption. I mean, this is a police force that has narco traffickers inside of it, people doing murder for hire rings, people doing carjackings. And then the more sort of mundane types of corruption, i.e. you arrest a gang member and take some money to let him go. So this was the type of stuff that was going on and contributed to this, not just the violence, but the lawlessness and the impunity for violence. And that was infuriating to people. And that's what really spurred Kurt and Carlos to say, we're going to take on this impunity problem with the goal of reducing violence.
It's a noble aim, Ross, but the thing is, you've got a country that's poor, you've got a, maybe the literacy program isn't great out there as well, and suddenly you've got all this money coming through, which you could obviously make a year's salary, perhaps in a week, perhaps in a weekend, because you let, if you let a certain thing come through, or you know, you are influenced, or you're bought off. So if you come in from, you know, as a gringo, as you put it, a lot of people are going to go, okay, well, yeah, nice try, but you know, say hello to my little friend, to use another film's parlance.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing, you know, the book starts off with Kurt, who's a gringo, and his partner Carlos doing this very radical, ambitious thing. But before that, I mean, he and his wife had spent, I guess, almost 20 years in the country, really learning it, getting to know it, and, like, for lack of a better word, establishing their bona fides there. And they were very respected people in this community and took the time to study it and learn it before diving in with this thing. But you're right. I mean, there are all sorts of gringos flying down there, doing missionary work, doing humanitarian work. And, you know, Kurt, at least, very much sees himself in opposition to those people. And him and his wife are certainly very critical of the people who, you know, pop down there for 2 weeks to construct a home, for example, that a local contractor could have built for less money than they paid for their flights and hotels. So there is elements of humanitarianism that they are critical of.
I suppose it's the whole thing. Look at me, I'm doing great work. So that actually, and it's almost, you know, it is that old sort of colonial missionary. You know, I'm bringing Christ to the people. And the people are like, well, we've already got Christ. We don't really need this one, but we need, you know, we need, as you said before, let's concentrate on the here and now. And they decide to take on, you know, when the situation. They understand the situation because they have been there for 20 years. They know the people, they know the structure, and they take direct action. I mean, they take by any means necessary, basically.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, look, I think when you're in a very violent and very lawless place, there's a bunch of people who get the idea of we need to do something to stop crime. But the standard response is violent vigilantism. And there's a lot of that in Honduras. There's a lot of that in this book. People, whether it's cops or private citizens, who say, screw it, we're done with these guys. We're going to get guns and go kill them. And people who just we think are members of this gang. And Kurt and Carlos also say, we don't like that. We don't want to do that. We want to do something else. And their solution is to solve homicides and other types of very serious gang crimes. So the way they do that is they hire a lawyer and a private eye, and eventually a psychologist. And that trio, you know, most people think of solving murders as something that the government should do and only the government should do. But if you think about the key steps and how it happens, you quickly realize that, like, you don't need a badge to do it. So, for example, the key factor is usually witnesses. It's someone knows what happened and is either willing to testify about it in court under oath or isn't. And in Honduras, that wasn't happening because people were terrified of retribution from the gang, and they did not trust cops and prosecutors and the people involved in that. So this trio that Kurt and Carlos hired would cultivate witnesses, figure out who they are, convince them to testify, and keep them alive. And then the other side of this was the cops didn't know who committed the crimes, where they lived, what they looked like, and this trio, this team, could gather all that information. You don't need to be a cop to figure that out. And they would deliver that to the cops. And then they would rent a car and take the police to where they needed to go to make the arrest. And then once the arrest was made, they would work with the prosecutor to get the prosecution done. I mean, the prosecutor had to argue in court, but these guys were behind the scenes pushing them, helping them, and most importantly, protecting the witnesses throughout the trial.
And I'm just thinking, because you're in danger of severely sort of mucking off the judiciary, the prosecutors, the police, and also you really are putting yourself in the line. But I suppose it runs on. And I know this sounds sort of very sort of hairy chested Hollywood movie sort of thing, but it's a presumption that there are good people there, and they are sick and tired of seeing Honduras being drugged, you know, being caricatured, the justice not being done, and they're just sick and tired of the corruption and the miscarriages of justice, if any justice at all.
No, I mean, you are hitting at something that is so key to Kurt and Carlos's philosophy and this book. They look at the situation, which everyone else sees as so hopeless, and they say, no, there are people who would testify and would step up, even though it is terrifying to do so in a place like this. And they're proven right. I mean, there are gang members and killers in this book who are some of the, you know, most intimidating people you could possibly imagine. And nevertheless, these ordinary people, these anonymous heroes, over and over again throughout the book, step up and they say, look, I'm sick of these guys. I will be the one to testify against this killer, the serial killer even. And it's incredible and it's inspiring and it's heroic. And on the flip side, you touched on this a little bit, you know, most people, they thought of the Honduran police force and they were just like, ah, these guys are scumbags. These guys are terrible. I've heard stories about this and that, and, you know, screw the cops. But Kurt and Carlos say, look, these are thousands of different people. There's obviously some really bad ones, some criminal ones, but we are positive that we can find good cops to work with, that we can find good prosecutors to work with. It's going to take some time to figure out who they are, but this private eye we hired, who is sort of from that world, can figure that out. So that's another premise of what they've done.
And presumably, I mean, everybody go, oh, well, yeah, it's a one that didn't end up, you know, getting you know, shot or something. But presumably, because it's insidious, isn't it? They probably got some offers saying, listen, just let this case go. Don't make any more investigations. And here's a large sum of dollars for you.
Yeah, I mean, the police were doing a lot of that in the neighborhood. I mean, and part of what drove people so nuts is, like, there was this gang that was killing people and doing everything you'd expect a messed up gang to do. And they would get arrested, but then they would always be free. So whether it was bribing cops or bribing prison guards to let them out of the prison, or even just like the prosecutor's cases wouldn't get, finalized because the witnesses wouldn't show up, the kids would get arrested and come right back. And it was because of all those reasons.
Well, how does it come across your radar then, Ross? I mean, where do you start with something like this? I mean, what was your aim? Was it pure reportage? Was it a look at a group of very, very brave and principled people who said, nada mas, no more, we're not going to put up with this. Where does your criminology and stroke journalism hat come on then? And how do you put something like this together?
Yeah, I mean, the starting point was I heard this idea. I heard about this program and I heard about the success. And I thought, like, wow, like, could that work in Chicago? Could that work in Louisville? Could that work in St. Louis, where the impunity and violence problem isn't as bad, but it's still pretty damn bad. So there was that initial fascination. But then I did put my journalism hat on, and I didn't write this book as an advocate of the idea or as an academic. I wrote it as a journalist and a storyteller, and it's really meant to be an immersive ride through these guys' very dramatic life. And, you know, it was very hard to report. I flew down to Honduras for the first time pretty soon after I met Kurt and had to figure all this out. It took a very long time. Honduras is not an easy place to get information. Things that you and I are used to being digitized and easily available are not down there, whether it's newspaper articles, court records, someone's phone number at the Ministry of X. And so it's very tedious. And then there's just getting sources is also very hard because, you know, this subject matter, we're talking about homicide and gangs and corrupt politicians, and it's stuff people are scared to talk about. So finding the sources who are willing to interview with you is not easy. And it took a long time, and Now, the last thing I'll say on that is I think one of the really good decisions that I made as a reporter was to live in Nueva Suyapa while I was down there. And that allowed me to really get to know the neighborhood, the details, the, you know, what it's like. And I hope that comes through in the book.
Because that is the thing. You know, we live in a world now, like I said at the beginning, it's very easy. Oh, from, you know, they're Central Americans. They're all criminals, drugs, rapists, the whole thing. The police are all corrupt. It's, you know, it is a no hope situation. Let's build a big jail. Let's throw anybody with a tattoo in that jail, et cetera, et cetera. But again, there are so many more levels to this. And also you have to say it is very easy for a police or a government or a foreign bureau to say, well, this is a basket case. We can't do anything about it. We'll just lock them all up. And yet these guys come along and go, actually, you know, this is the way it works. And we've bought prosecutions where you would just gave up and said there was no hope for it, which goes to say, if these two individuals and their team can do it, then why can't a government, why can't a judiciary, you know, get their tiny minds around it?
No, I think that's right. And the first part of the book is really about this program where they're essentially replicating the work of police and prosecutors. And they do that with a lot of success in their own neighborhood. And then they expand it to a number of other similar ones. And there's actually a team of independent researchers come in and who evaluate it and show how effective it is at reducing the number of homicides. But then fast forward to 2011, and Honduras is the country with the highest homicide rate in the world. The narco trafficking problem is out of control. The Mara problem is out of control, which is the gang problem for your listeners who don't know that term. And Kurt and Carl say, look, like, we can keep doing this program to a certain degree, but if we want to help the entire country become safer, the only way to do that is to reform the actual police force itself and the actual public ministry itself. So they shift gears, and their charity goes from being this clandestine, under-the-radar thing to being this very political, very public, very large, very formal thing. And the way that they're going to be able to fix those institutions is acquiring political power. And they do that, and this happens towards the back end of the book. They become people who are meeting with presidents and ambassadors and people who are in the news all the time and become very important. And they have a lot of success in this front too. I mean, their number one goal from the beginning here is to purge the police, which is basically to fire all the bad cops and try to prosecute the criminal ones and replace them with better ones. And they end up firing about half of the police force. This is something that people have been wanting to do in Honduras for a very long time, but no one had the guts to do. They pull it off. They get the country's attorney general fired, push through a bunch of reforms through the attorney general's office, and have a lot of success. But it's not without these sort of moral and ethical gray areas that they have to wade into. And that's a theme throughout the entire book.
Unfortunately, yeah, life is not a Hollywood movie where everybody sort of turns and goes, and there you are, yes, I have seen the light. But a Hollywood movie of this, Ross, has to be at least a miniseries at least. What are you hoping that people are going to take? A better understanding? Because again, you mentioned Honduras and people probably go, where, what, how? What are you hoping people are going to take from Bear Witness?
Yeah, look, I think exactly. I mean, part of it is, especially here in the United States, we hear so much about Honduran migrants and people getting deported to Honduras, but rarely do we get to like go inside the country and really see what it's like. And I think this book does provide a pretty nuanced portrait. I mean, we're focused today in this conversation on, you know, the crime and stuff like that, but you get to see all these heroic people doing different things, the different neighborhoods, the different government offices. And I think that's hopefully will be interesting for people. Look, for people interested in issues of crime and justice and policing and incarceration, I think this is a valuable story because you get to see those things in extremis. And this idea that these guys have come up with sorts of tests a lot of our assumptions about those things. And I think anyone interested in, like, you know, humanitarianism or missionary work and like how people go about helping others, this is a huge, I don't want to use the word industry, but a huge thing that people do. And these guys have lots of different ideas about that. And you get to see that in action. And I think it's just an inspiring story and one with lots of twists and turns, lots of amazing accomplishments, sad moments. So I hope even if you don't have interest in those specific issues, you can enjoy the book.
The book is called Bear Witness, The Pursuit of Justice in a Violent Land. It's by Ross Halperin, who's speaking to today. Listeners, you can order it. Go forth to the Talk Radio bookstore. You will see a cover of the book. Click on it and a well-known distribution service will have it winging its way to you. Russ, if people want to find you online, have a conversation, say really nice things to you, where's the best place to find you?
So I have a website that is www.rossahalperin.com. And then I'm on Instagram and X and all the social medias too.
The book is called Bear Witness. It's by Ross Halperin. Ross, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you, sir. This was great.
This holiday season, reach for the one butter that never disappoints, Kerrygold. Made with milk from grass-fed cows on Irish family farms, it's rich, creamy, and perfect for baking. Whether browning butter for cookies or crafting the flakiest pie crust, Kerrygold's high butterfat content makes all the difference in flavor and texture. Holiday treats will taste extraordinary.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.